Chapter 17. Even today, little has ever been revealed concerning the weapons used in the Battle of Pico. It is known that missiles played only a minor part in the engagement. In space warfare, anything short of a direct hit is almost useless, since there is nothing to transmit the energy of a shockwave. An atom bomb exploding a few hundred meters away can cause no blast damage, and even its radiation can do little harm to well-protected structures. Moreover, both Earth and the Federation had effective means of diverting ordinary projectiles. Purely non-material weapons would have to play the greatest role. The simplest of these were the ion beams, developed directly from the drive units of spaceships. Since the invention of the first radio tubes, almost 3 centuries before, men had been learning how to produce and focus ever more concentrated streams of charged particles. The climax had been reached in space propulsion, with the so-called ion rocket generating its thrust from the emission of intense beams of electrically charged particles. The deadlines of these beams had caused many accidents in space, even though they were deliberately defocused to limit their effective range. There was, of course, an obvious answer to such weapons. The electric and magnetic fields which produced them could also be used for their dispersion, converting them from annihilating beams into a harmless scattered spray. More effective, but more difficult to build, were the weapons using pure radiation. Yet even here, both Earth and the Federation had succeeded. It remained to be seen which had done the better job: the superior science of the Federation or the greater productive capacity of Earth. Commodore Brennan was well aware of all these factors as his little fleet converged upon the moon. Like all commanders, he was going into action with fewer resources than he would have wished. Indeed, he would very much have preferred not to be going into action at all. The converted liner Eridanus and the largely rebuilt freighter Lethe, once listed in Lloyd's register as the Morning Star and the Rigel, would now be swinging in between Earth and Moon along their carefully plotted courses. He did not know if they still had the element of surprise. Even if they had been detected, Earth might not know of the existence of this third and largest ship, the Acheron. Brennan wondered what romantic with a taste for mythology was responsible for these names. Probably Commissioner Churchill, who made a point of emulating his famous ancestor in as many ways as he possibly could. Yet they were not inappropriate. The rivers of death and oblivion. Yes, these were things they might bring to many men before another day had passed. Lieutenant Curtis, one of the few men in the crew who had actually spent most of his working life in space, looked up from the communications desk.
"Message just picked up from the moon, sir. Addressed to us."
Brennan was badly shaken. If they had been spotted, surely their opponents were not so contemptuous of them that they would freely admit the fact. He glanced quickly at the signal, then gave a sigh of relief. "Observatory to Federation. Wish to remind you of existence irreplaceable instruments Plato. Also entire observatory staff still here. McLaurin, Director."
"Don't frighten me like that again, Curtis," said the Commodore. "I thought you meant it was beamed at me. I'd hate to think they could detect us this far out."
"Sorry, sir, it's just a general broadcast. They're still sending it out on the observatory wavelength."
Brennan handed the signal over to his operations controller, Captain Merton.
"What do you make of this? You worked there, didn't you?"
Merton smiled as he read the message.
"Just like McLaurin. Instruments first, staff second. I'm not too worried. I'll do my damnedest to miss him. 100 kilometers isn't a bad safety margin when you come to think of it. Unless it's a direct hit with a stray, they've nothing to worry about. They're pretty well dug in, you know."
The relentless hand of the chronometer was scything away the last minutes. Still confident that his ship, encased in its cocoon of night, had not yet been detected, Commodore Brennan watched the 3 sparks of his fleet creep along their appointed tracks in the plotting sphere. It was not a destiny he had ever imagined would be his.
to hold the fate of worlds within his hands. But he was not thinking of the powers that slumbered in the reactor banks, waiting for his command. He was not concerned with the place he would take in history when men looked back upon this day. He only wondered, as had all who had ever faced battle for the first time, where he would be this same time tomorrow. Less than 1,000,000 kilometers away, Carl Stefansson sat at a control desk and watched the image of the sun picked up by one of the many cameras that were the eyes of Project Thor. The group of tired technicians standing around him had almost completed the equipment before his arrival. Now, the discriminating units he had brought from Earth in such desperate haste had been wired into the circuit. Stefansson turned a knob and the sun went out. He flicked from one camera position to another, but all the eyes of the fortress were equally blind. The coverage was complete. Too weary to feel any exhilaration, he leaned back in his seat and gestured toward the controls. "It's up to you now. Set it to pass enough light for vision, but to give total rejection from the ultraviolet upward. We're sure none of their beams carry any effective power much beyond 1,000 angstroms. They'll be very surprised when all their stuff bounces off. I only wish we could send it back the way it came." "Wonder what we look like from outside when the screen's on," said one of the engineers. "Just like a perfectly reflecting mirror. As long as it keeps reflecting, we're safe against pure radiation. That's all I can promise you." Stefansson looked at his watch. "If intelligence is correct, we have about 20 minutes to spare, but I shouldn't count on it." "At least McLaurin knows where we are," said Jameson as he switched off the radio. "But I can't blame him for not sending someone to pull us out."
"Then what do we do now?"
"Get some food," Jameson answered, walking back to the tiny galley. "I think we've earned it, and there may be a long walk ahead of us." Wheeler looked nervously across the plain to the distant but all too clearly visible dome of Project Thor. Then his jaw dropped, and it was some seconds before he could believe that his eyes were not playing tricks on him.
"Sid," he called, "come and look at this."
Jameson joined him at a rush, and together they stared out toward the horizon. The partly shadowed hemisphere of the dome had changed its appearance completely. Instead of a thin crescent of light, it now showed a single dazzling star, as though the image of the sun was being reflected from a perfectly spherical mirror surface. The telescope confirmed this impression. The dome itself was no longer visible. Its place seemed to have been taken by this fantastic silver apparition. To Wheeler, it looked exactly like a great blob of mercury sitting on the skyline.
"I'd like to know how they've done that," was Jameson's unexcited comment. "Some kind of interference effect, I suppose. It must be part of their defense system."
"We'd better get moving," said Wheeler anxiously. "I don't like the look of this. It feels horribly exposed up here." Jameson had started throwing open cupboards and pulling out stores. He tossed some bars of chocolate and packets of compressed meat over to Wheeler.
"Start chewing some of this," he said. "We won't have time for a proper meal now. Better have a drink as well, if you're thirsty. But don't take too much. You'll be in that suit for hours, and these aren't luxury models."
Wheeler was doing some mental arithmetic. They must be about 80 kilometers from base, with the entire rampart of Plato between them and the observatory. Yes, it would be a long walk home, and they might, after all, be safer here. The tractor, which had already served them so well, could protect them from a good deal of trouble. Jameson toyed with the idea, but then rejected it. "Remember what Stefansson said," he reminded Wheeler. "He told us to get underground as soon as we could, and he must know what he's talking about." They found a crevasse within 50 meters of the tractor on the slope of the ridge away from the fortress. It was just deep enough to see out of when they stood upright, and the floor was sufficiently level to lie down. As a slit trench, it might almost have been made to order, and Jameson felt much happier when he had located it.
"The only thing that worries me now," he said, "is how long we may have to wait. It's still possible that nothing will happen at all. On the other hand, if we start walking, we may be caught in the open, away from shelter."
After some discussion, they decided on a compromise. They would keep their suits on, but would go back and sit in Ferdinand, where at least they would be comfortable. It would take them only a few seconds to get to the trench. There was no warning of any kind. Suddenly, the gray, dusty rocks of the Sea of Rains were scorched by a light they had never known before in all their history. Wheeler's first impression was that someone had turned a giant searchlight full upon the tractor. Then he realized that this sun-eclipsing explosion was many kilometers away. High above the horizon was a ball of violet flame, perfectly spherical and rapidly losing brilliance as it expanded. Within seconds, it had faded to a great cloud of luminous gas. It was dropping down toward the edge of the moon, and almost at once had sunk below the skylight like some fantastic sun.
"We were fools," said Jameson gravely. "That was an atomic warhead. We may be dead men already."
"Nonsense," retorted Wheeler, though without much confidence. "That was 50 kilometers away. The gammas would be pretty weak by the time they reached us, and these walls aren't bad shielding." Jameson did not answer. He was already on his way to the airlock. Wheeler started to follow him, then remembered that there was a radiation detector aboard and went back to collect it. Was there something else that might be useful while he was here? On a sudden impulse, he jerked down the curtain rod above the little alcove that concealed the lavatory, then ripped away the wall mirror over the sink. When he joined Jameson, who was waiting impatiently for him in the airlock, he handed over the detector but did not bother to explain the rest of his equipment. Not until they had settled down in their trench, which they reached without further incident, did he make its purpose clear. "If there's one thing I hate," he said petulantly, "it's not being able to see what's going on." He started to fix the mirror to the curtain rod, using some wire from one of the pouches round his suit. After a couple of minutes' work, he was able to hoist a crude periscope out of the hole. "I can just see the dome," he said with some satisfaction. "It's quite unchanged, as far as I can tell."
"It would be," Jameson replied. "They must have managed to explode that bomb somehow while it was miles away."
"Perhaps it was only a warning shot."
"Not likely. No one wastes plutonium for firework displays. That meant business. I wonder when the next move is going to be."
It did not come for another 5 minutes. Then, almost simultaneously, three more of the dazzling atomic suns burst against the sky. They were all moving on trajectories that took them toward the dome, but long before they reached it, they had dispersed into tenuous clouds of vapor.
"Rounds 1 and 2 to Earth," muttered Wheeler. "I wonder where these missiles are coming from." "If any of them burst directly overhead," said Jameson, "we will be done for. Don't forget that there's no atmosphere to absorb the gammas here."
"What does the radiation meter say?"
"Nothing much yet, but I'm worried about that first blast when we were still in the tractor."
Wheeler was too busily searching the sky to answer. Somewhere up there among the stars, which he could see now that he was out of the direct glare of the sun, must be the ships of the Federation, preparing for the next attack. It was not likely that the ships themselves would be visible, but he might be able to see their weapons in action. From somewhere beyond Pico, 6 sheaves of flame shot up into the sky at an enormous acceleration. The dome was launching its first missiles straight into the face of the sun. The Lethe and the Eridanus were using a trick as old as warfare itself. They were approaching from a direction in which their opponent would be partly blinded. Even radar could be distracted by the background of solar interference, and Commodore Brennan had enlisted 2 large sunspots as minor allies. Within seconds, the rockets were lost in the glare. Minutes seemed to pass. Then the sunlight abruptly multiplied itself 100-fold. "The folks up on Earth," thought Wheeler as he readjusted the filters of his visor, "will be having a grandstand view tonight. And the atmosphere, which is such a nuisance to astronomers, will protect them from anything that these warheads can radiate." There was no way to tell if the missiles had done any damage. That enormous and soundless explosion might have dissipated itself harmlessly into space.
This would be a strange battle, he realized. He might never even see the Federation ships, which would almost certainly be painted as black as night to make them undetectable. Then he saw that something was happening to the dome. It was no longer a gleaming spherical mirror reflecting only the single image of the sun. Light was splashing from it in all directions, and its brilliance was increasing second by second. From somewhere out in space, power was being poured into the fortress. That could only mean that the ships of the Federation were floating up there against the stars, beaming countless millions of kilowatts down upon the moon. But there was still no sign of them, for there was nothing to reveal the track of the river of energy pouring invisibly through space. The dome was now far too bright to look upon directly, and Wheeler readjusted his filters. He wondered when it was going to reply to the attack, or indeed if it could do so while it was under this bombardment. Then he saw that the hemisphere was surrounded by a wavering corona, like some kind of brush discharge. Almost at the same moment, Jameson's voice rang in his ears. "Look, Con, right overhead!" He glanced away from the mirror and looked directly into the sky. For the first time, he saw one of the Federation ships. Though he did not know it, he was seeing the Acheron, the only spaceship ever to be built specifically for war. It was clearly visible and seemed remarkably close. Between it and the fortress, like an impalpable shield, flared a disk of light which, as he watched, turned cherry red, then blue-white, then the deadly searing violet seen only in the hottest of the stars. The shield wavered back and forth, giving the impression of being balanced by tremendous and opposite energies. As Wheeler stared, oblivious to his peril, he saw that the whole ship was surrounded by a faint halo of light, brought to incandescence only where the weapons of the fortress tore against it. It was some time before he realized that there were two other ships in the sky, each shielded by its own flaming nimbus. Now the battle was beginning to take shape. Each side had cautiously tested its defenses and its weapons, and only now had the real trial of strength begun. The two astronomers stared in wonder at the moving fireballs of the ships. Here was something totally new, something far more important than any mere weapon. These vessels possessed a means of propulsion which must make the rocket obsolete. They could hover motionless at will, then move off in any direction at a high acceleration. They needed this mobility. The fortress, with all its fixed equipment, far outpowered them, and much of their defense lay in their speed. In utter silence, the battle was rising to its climax. Millions of years ago, the molten rock had frozen to form the Sea of Rains, and now the weapons of the ships were turning it once more to lava. Out by the fortress, clouds of incandescent vapor were being blasted into the sky as the beams of the attackers spent their fury against the unprotected rocks. It was impossible to tell which side was inflicting the greater damage. Now and again, a screen would flare up as a flicker of heat passes over white-hot steel. When that happened to one of the battleships, it would move away with that incredible acceleration, and it would be several seconds before the focusing devices of the fort had located it again. Both Wheeler and Jameson were surprised that the battle was being fought at such short ranges. There was probably never more than 100 kilometers between the antagonists, and usually it was much less than this. When one fought with weapons that traveled at the speed of light, indeed, when one fought with light itself, such distances were trivial. The explanation did not occur to them until the end of the engagement. All radiation weapons have one limitation. They must obey the law of inverse squares. Only explosive missiles are equally effective from whatever range they have been projected. If one is hit by an atomic bomb, it makes no difference whether it has traveled 10 kilometers or 1,000. But double the distance of any kind of radiation weapon, and you divide its power by 4, owing to the spreading of the beam. No wonder, therefore, that the Federal commander was coming as close to his objective as he dared. The fort, lacking mobility, had to accept any punishment the ships could give it. After the battle had been on for a few minutes, it was impossible for the unshielded eye to look anywhere toward the south.
Ever and again, the clouds of rock vapor would go sailing up into the sky, falling back on the ground like luminous steam. And presently, as he peered through his darkened goggles and maneuvered his clumsy periscope, Wheeler saw something he could scarcely believe. Around the base of the fortress was a slowly spreading circle of lava, melting down ridges and even small hillocks like lumps of wax. That awe-inspiring sight brought home to him, as nothing else had done, the frightful power of the weapons that were being wielded only a few kilometers away. If even the merest stray reflection of those energies reached them here, they would be snuffed out of existence as swiftly as moths in an oxyhydrogen flame. The three ships appeared to be moving in some complex tactical pattern, so that they could maintain the maximum bombardment of the fort while reducing its opportunity of striking back. Several times, one of the ships passed vertically overhead, and Wheeler retreated as far into the crack as he could, in case any of the radiation scattered from the screens splashed down upon them. Jameson, who had given up trying to persuade his colleague to take fewer risks, had now crawled some distance along the crevasse, looking for a deeper part, preferably with a good overhang. He was not so far away, however, that the rock was shielding the suit radios, and Wheeler gave him a continuous commentary on the battle. It was hard to believe that the entire engagement had not yet lasted 10 minutes. As Wheeler cautiously surveyed the inferno to the south, he noticed that the hemisphere seemed to have lost some of its symmetry. At first, he thought that one of the generators might have failed, so that the protective field could no longer be maintained. Then he saw that the lake of lava was at least a kilometer across, and he guessed that the whole fort had floated off its foundations. Probably the defenders were not even aware of the fact. Their insulation must be taking care of solar heats, and would hardly notice the modest warmth of molten rock. And now a strange thing was beginning to happen. The rays with which the battle was being fought were no longer quite visible, for the fortress was no longer in a vacuum. Around it, the boiling rock was releasing enormous volumes of gas, through which the paths of the rays were as clearly visible as searchlights in a misty night on Earth. At the same time, Wheeler began to notice a continual hail of tiny particles around him. For a moment, he was puzzled. Then he realized that the rock vapor was condensing after it had been blasted up into the sky. It seemed too light to be dangerous, and he did not mention it to Jameson. It would only give him something else to worry about. As long as the dust fall was not too heavy, the normal insulation of the suits could deal with it. In any case, it would probably be quite cold by the time it got back to the surface. The tenuous and temporary atmosphere around the dome was producing another unexpected effect. Occasional flashes of lightning darted between ground and sky, draining off the enormous static charges that must be accumulating around the fort. Some of those flashes would have been spectacular by themselves, but they were scarcely visible against the incandescent clouds that generated them. Accustomed though he was to the eternal silences of the moon, Wheeler still felt a sense of unreality at the sight of these tremendous forces striving together without the least whisper of sound. Sometimes a gentle vibration would reach him, perhaps the rock-borne concussion of falling lava. But much of the time, he had the feeling that he was watching a television program when the sound had failed. Afterward, he could hardly believe he had been such a fool as to expose himself to the risks he was running now. At the moment, he felt no fear, only an immense curiosity and excitement. He had been caught, though he did not know it, by the deadly glamour of war. There is a fatal strain in men that, whatever reason may say, makes their hearts beat faster when they watch the colors flying and hear the ancient music of the drums. Curiously enough, Wheeler did not feel any sense of identification with either side. It seemed to him, in his present abnormally overwrought mood, that all this was a vast, impersonal display arranged for his special benefit. He felt something approaching contempt for Jameson, who was missing everything by seeking safety. Perhaps the real truth of the matter was that, having just escaped from one peril, Wheeler was in the exalted state akin to drunkenness,
in which the idea of personal danger seems absurd. He had managed to get out of the Dust Bowl. Nothing else could harm him now. Jameson had no such consolation. He saw little of the battle, but felt its terror and grandeur far more deeply than his friend. It was too late for regrets, but over and over again he wrestled with his conscience. He felt angry at fate for having placed him in such a position that his action might have decided the destiny of worlds. He was angry in equal measure with Earth and the Federation for having let matters come to this, and he was sick at heart as he thought of the future toward which the human race might now be heading. Wheeler never knew why the fortress waited so long before it used its main weapon. Perhaps Stefansson, or whoever was in charge, was waiting for the attack to slacken so that he could risk lowering the defenses of the dome for the millisecond that he needed to launch his stiletto. Wheeler saw it strike upward, a solid bar of light stabbing at the stars. He remembered the rumors that had gone round the observatory. So this was what had been seen, flashing above the mountains. He did not have time to reflect on the staggering violation of the laws of optics which this phenomenon implied, for he was staring at the ruined ship above his head. The beam had gone through the Lethe as if she did not exist. The fortress had speared her as an entomologist pierces a butterfly with a pin. Whatever one's loyalties, it was a terrible thing to see how the screens of that great ship suddenly vanished as her generators died, leaving her helpless and unprotected in the sky. The secondary weapons of the fort were at her instantly, tearing out great gashes of metal and boiling away her armor layer by layer. Then, quite slowly, she began to settle toward the moon, still on an even keel. No one will ever know what stopped her. Probably some short circuit in her controls, since none of her crew could have been left alive. For suddenly she went off to the east in a long, flat trajectory. By that time, most of her hull had been boiled away, and the skeleton of her framework was almost completely exposed. The crash came minutes later as she plunged out of sight beyond the Tenerife Mountains. A blue-white aurora flickered for a moment below the horizon, and Wheeler waited for the shock to reach him. And then, as he stared into the east, he saw a line of dust rising from the plain, sweeping toward him as if driven by a mighty wind. The concussion was racing through the rock, hurling the surface dust high into the sky as it passed. The swift, inexorable approach of that silently moving wall, advancing at the rate of several kilometers a second, was enough to strike terror into anyone who did not know its cause. But it was quite harmless. When the wave front reached him, it was as if a minor earthquake had passed. The veil of dust reduced visibility to zero for a few seconds, then subsided as swiftly as it had come. When Wheeler looked again for the remaining ships, they were so far away that their screens had shrunk to little balls of fire against the zenith. At first, he thought they were retreating. Then, abruptly, the screens began to expand as they came down into the attack under the terrific vertical acceleration. Over by the fortress, the lava, like some tortured living creature, was throwing itself madly into the sky as the beams tore into it. The Acheron and Eridanus came out of their dives about a kilometer above the fort. For an instant, they were motionless. Then they went back into the sky together. But the Eridanus had been mortally wounded, though Wheeler knew only that one of the screens was shrinking much more slowly than the other. With a feeling of helpless fascination, he watched the stricken ship fall back toward the moon. He wondered if the fort would use its enigmatic weapon again, or whether the defenders realized that it was unnecessary. About 10 kilometers up, the screens of the Eridanus seemed to explode, and she hung unprotected, a blunt torpedo of black metal, almost invisible against the sky. Instantly, her light-absorbing paint and the armor beneath were torn off by the beams of the fortress. The great ship turned cherry red, then white. She swung over so that her prow turned toward the moon and began her last dive. At first, it seemed to Wheeler that she was heading straight toward him. Then he saw that she was aimed at the fort. She was obeying her captain's last command. It was almost a direct hit. The dying ship smashed into the lake of lava and exploded instantly, engulfing the fortress in an expanding hemisphere of flame. This, thought Wheeler, must surely be the end. He waited for the shockwave to reach him, and again watched the wall of dust sweep by, this time into the north. The concussion was so violent that it jerked him off his feet, and he did not see how anyone in the fort could have survived. Cautiously, he put down the mirror which had given him almost all his view of the battle and peered over the edge of his trench. He did not know that the final paroxysm was yet to come. Incredibly, the dome was still there, though now it seemed that part of it had been sheared away. And it was inert and lifeless. Its screens were down, its energies exhausted, its garrison surely already dead. If so, they had done their work. Of the remaining Federal ship, there was no sign. She was already retreating toward Mars, her main armament completely useless, and her drive units on the point of failure. She would never fight again. Yet in the few hours of life that were left to her, she had one more role to play. "It's all over, Sid," Wheeler called into his suit radio. "It's safe to come and look now." Jameson climbed up out of a crack 50 meters away, holding the radiation detector in front of him. "It's still hot around here," Wheeler heard him grumble, half to himself. "The sooner we get moving, the better." "Will it be safe to go back to Ferdinand and put through a radio?" began Wheeler. Then he stopped. Something was happening over by the dome. In a blast like an erupting volcano, the ground tore apart. An enormous geyser began to soar into the sky, hurling great boulders thousands of meters toward the stars. It climbed swiftly above the plain, driving a thunderhead of smoke and spray before it. For a moment it towered against the southern sky, like some incredible heaven-aspiring tree that had sprung from the barren soil of the moon. Then, almost as swiftly as it had grown, it subsided in silent ruin, and its angry vapors dispersed into space. The thousands of tons of heavy liquid holding open the deepest shaft that man had ever bored had finally come to the boiling point, as the energies of the battle seeped into the rock. The mine had blown its top as spectacularly as any oil well on Earth, and had proved that an excellent explosion could still be arranged without the aid of atom bombs.